Okay, I hope you had a good lunch break and are ready to welcome Jono Bacon with his explanation how to hurt cats and influence people.
Thank you. Everyone all right?
Yes.
Crap. Everyone all right?
No.
All right, you've got one more time. Okay, there's Matthews A over there. They're in the wrong talk. Make them hear it. Everyone all right?
Yes.
Thank you. Wow, I'm scared. Good afternoon. My name's Jono Bacon, and I work for Canonical as the Ubuntu Community Manager. And a lot of people kind of refer to this kind of work as herding cats. And I've got a brilliant video about herding cats, which I was going to put in here, but I haven't had time. Herding cats. So my job is falls into a few different roles. You know, on one side, I go out to conferences and I do talks and talk to interesting people and some non-interesting people. And a lot of so-called community people at vendors tend to do that kind of stuff. It's more of an outreach sort of thing. And then on the other side, it's actually helping to run and organize the community better. So that's kind of like looking at ways to optimize things and looking at ways in which we can get different teams talking to each other. And the aim of this talk is to share some of these things with you guys. So it's about building better communities, getting more stuff done. And that's the basic kind of premise. Now, before I start, don't like talks where you lot are silent, so shout stuff out.
Stuff out!
Comedy. I mean, those kind of talks where someone's la 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 la. If you think I'm telling lies, then feel free to shout out that I'm telling lies. And I am going to be telling some lies, so keep you on your feet. Now, what? No. I'll tell you what, I'll give you a free copy of Ubuntu. Now, open source free software. When you hear these words, they tend to trigger certain things in your mind. Some of you will think of kernels. Some of you will think of desktops. Let me ask you a question. What words spring into your head? Shout them out.
Annex.
Camels.
Yes.
Okay.
Band-aids.
Open source. Ah. Terrible. Has anyone got any better comedy suggestions?
Beers.
You can usually tell what kind of audience you're going to get when you ask this question. It's how quickly the stupid words tend to come out, so you guys are doing quite well. I thought of some of these things, and these are the ones that kind of sprung to mind, you know, distributions. Ponies for our Ubuntu friends. Geeks, podcasts. Web 2.0 and TagCloud a little bit small because they're completely pointless. Planet, obviously Goatsy. Oh, is there?
Yeah.
There's something wrong with pointing out that I've misspelled Goatsy. Okay, so I was thinking about this, and the one word that always springs out is, of course, this word, community. People talk about community left, right, and center. And the reason for that is because you can't say the word community and it be a bad thing. Every time someone references the word community, it's an outreach sort of thing. So on one side, you've got people like us. We understand what community is. We understand the ethic of open source and free software. When we say it, we know what we're talking about. But then you've got some leeches, some companies who've appeared and disappeared in the past who don't really understand it and they just want to improve relations with the so-called open source community, and they use it. And it's a good PR scam for a lot of these people. But when doing kind of herding cats, you need to really understand what this word means. And that in itself is pretty difficult. How do we understand what this word means? You know, how can I understand what the single human interpretation of the word community means? How can I find out what mankind, womankind, dogkind, catkind, what they think this word means? Okay, some suggestions. Thing is, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, there must be a way of discovering the answer to this question, and I came up with it. Yeah, oh, come on, more of that. Ooh. Pathetic. Come on. Ooh. Are you excited? Well, screw you guys. I was thinking about this, and it was clear to me. It came in an instant, just a moment of epiphany. You type it into Google Images Search. As you're about to see, Safe Search wasn't turned on. Because for some reason, this image appeared. Now, I was looking at this and I was thinking, there's some, you know, reasonably good-looking ladies there, laid on some kind of hospital equipment with it looked like a blood transfusion or something, and I thought, that ticks all the boxes for one of my slides, so I put that in there. Nothing to do with community. What kind of blood community? The other one that came up was this. Some kind of ground user group. I mean, what's all that about? So I was looking at this, and what's clear is that, you know, community is, it's people. It's people who share a common interest, a common ambition. And of course, we know the open source community. This is the Debian crew. You know it's an open source community because one of the guys has got green hair. Okay? And is that you?
Yeah.
Wow, why is it not green anymore? I think you might have washed it. So the open source community, but it's different, the open source community, because we're not just a kind of fanboy user group. You know, some of us are, but most of it is it's working with each other to create things. It's not just about supporting things. So when you're thinking about community with open source, of course, you've got to think about how people work together to achieve certain goals and certain ambitions and things like that. And with this comes a whole new metric of things that we need to think about and understand when we're thinking about herding cats, when we're thinking about managing communities effectively. And I was thinking through this when I joined Canonical. I was thinking, I want to kind of understand the core ambitions behind effectively managing community. And I've managed to get it down to 4 approximate rules. And I'm going to demonstrate this with the magical power of dots. Okay? This is a representation of the open source community. Okay? So these might be, documentation, like the yellow ones. The blue ones might be packages. You know, the kind of bizarre gray, they're not that bizarre, gray ones, they might be translators. You've got these different types of people, okay? And they're scattered all over the place. Most of you in this room will know someone else in this room, and you've probably sat together next to your friends. Those of you who haven't got anyone sat next to you obviously have no friends. But you've got these randomly scattered groups of people. And if everyone came into this room and didn't know anybody else, no one would talk to each other. But when you know people, when you have a shared interest, it's different. So if I put some signs up and said, people interested in usability, come here. People interested in Perl, come here. You'd get these different groups forming, and then people would develop relationships. People would, you know, stop sniggering about Perl.
And it's on one side and Perl's on the other.
So you'd have these different groups of people, and they start talking to each other. There's a common interest, some bonding would start happening. People would start becoming friends, okay? So the very first step is to get groups of people together. And this sounds easy. And it is easy. You've just kind of got to figure out ways in which you can develop little sub-communities of people. So that's the very first step. Now, the second step is getting these teams to talk to each other. When I joined Canonical, one of our biggest projects is the Loco project, where we have different community teams around the world. So, for example, there's a UK team, there's a Texas team, you know, there's a Turkish team. And all of these different teams do approximately the same kind of stuff, advocacy, they do, they send out CDs to people and things like that. But no one talked to each other. No one. So the first step I thought was, well, let's get these people sharing experiences. Like the Belgian team, they go out to computer fairs and they demonstrate Ubuntu at computer fairs. And they've figured out how to do that right. They made a few mistakes and they've learned from those mistakes, but they never shared that with anybody else. Not because they didn't want to, just because it wasn't intrinsic in the project. So set up a mailing list and some wiki pages. You know, everything could be solved with wiki pages. And things started growing, and now a community starts working together. So that's rule number 2. Rule number 3, new people. New people, getting new people into projects is difficult. But when you talk to a lot of open source developers and you say, you know, how are you going to get new people involved? Most people think, well, that's easy. I just stick up a wiki page, maybe say where the mailing list is, say where the IRC channel is, job done. That is telling people that your project exists. That's not getting people involved. And one of the big problems with this is that getting people involved in a project is fundamentally impossible to achieve. And the reason for this is because you've got an old guard of people who know each other, people who've already established relationships, and then you've got these new people. And for new people, when they join a project and they want to get involved, A, you've got to have a certain amount of social prowess to get involved with a group of people you don't know, and B, it's even harder to get involved when there's all of these in-jokes and existing relationships already there. Now, a lot of people will say, it's like, look, how many people are here in LUGs? LUGs, Linux user groups. Linux user groups. Okay, so reasonable amount. Any BSD user groups? Are you both in the same group? It's like, hey, BSD person. You know, so you get, imagine like someone goes to a LUG, and it's the first time there, they meet up, and there's a bunch of people, and they all sit next to the same people. They always have the same conversations, there's the same in-jokes. That's very difficult to get over for a lot of people. So it's a very difficult challenge. The solution a lot of people say is, well, we should make the old guard, the people who've got these relationships, sit next to different people. But when you start mandating that, people don't want to go to the group anymore because they want to go there and sit next to their friends and have those conversations. It's a very difficult challenge to kind of get over. Now the next one, this is number four, this is the most important thing, right? Make sure the environment is conducive to getting stuff done, right? If you take nothing else away from this presentation, take away that sentence. I know some of you are going to be looking at me and thinking, you know, I'm going to take away your dashing good looks and your athleticism. You know, some of you, I'm going to rock someone's world. Some of you may take away that picture of the two girls, like laid on the thing. But take away this sentence. Make an environment that's conducive to getting stuff done. There's too many environments that are conducive to getting stuff discussed on mailing lists. That's what we wanted to get away from. And again, this is not something that you can just tell people to do. There needs to be a culture. There needs to be a culture of making stuff happen. People don't join communities because they have interesting discussions on mailing lists. People join communities because they get stuff done. They make interesting things happen. They make software work. And that's the most critical thing. And for the early community adopters, you need to make sure that it's all about, let's discuss this, let's flesh out some ideas, but let's actually do this. Let's make this happen. Okay? Pick reasonable goals and make them happen. So you've got these four things, right? How on earth do you do these? You find good people. Finding good people is the key thing. Now, finding good people, I'm not talking about getting very clever, very wise people. I'm not talking about getting certain demographics of groups of people. I'm talking about getting people who understand the community spirit behind what we're doing. And these people generally fall into two camps. So over this side, right, you've got people who get it, people who understand what's going on. These people understand what community is. They're good at what they chose to do, whether it's documentation or programming or whatever. These people generally get it. Now, over this side, this is the real side that you really care about, are people who are good people. They're good people to be in your community, but they don't quite get it. They might not be very good at programming, but they really want to be part of your project. They might be good at programming, but they don't quite understand how to work with other people. They might be very technically good, but they just don't have much motivation. You know, there's just a piece of the jigsaw missing. These are the people you want to spend your time working on. Those lot, they're going to be successful anyway, whether you're there or not. These are the people we need to concentrate on, and we need to lower the bar for these people. Now, there are idiots, and they don't fall into the category of either of these. And you can tell these a mile off. Most of them are commenting on Slashdot as we speak. So, have a swig. Find good people. Now, once you've found these good people, the challenge is getting these people working. We want to make these people good workers inside your project. And it's at times like this, I think it's always good to look at prior experience of where people have succeeded in similar kind of things. A couple of days ago, I did a talk in Jakosha, and there was like a random usability discussion in the GNOME Love session. And one of the things I said in there was, a great example of good design, a really good example, is the condom. It's a really simple, intuitive, it's cheap to manufacture, it's one of the greatest inventions, you know, that we've got. Some of you are looking unconvinced. Some of you are looking like you've got kids because the condom didn't work. Some of you are looking like you've never seen a condom before. Most of you are looking like you've never seen a condom before. So you look at this best practice in kind of like trendy speak. And I was thinking of a way in which to try and visualize and try and get over, you know, how this should be done. And I was stumped when I was making these slides for a good analogy. And then I was driving back from the meeting one day, and it struck me. The solution is this guy. Yes, McDonald's. Love or hate them, McDonald's are very successful. How many people love McDonald's?
How many people hate McDonald's? How many people are indifferent to McDonald's? Okay. Love, hate, or be indifferent to McDonald's, they're a very successful company. What they've done is they've based their much of their success in defining a good way of doing things. Okay? Their success is partially because they've got they're business savvy, they've adopted new markets, they've offered interesting products to people, and they've created relationships with people like Disney and things like that. That's part of their success. But their whole business is based upon a process. And this is the process. They take pretty uninteresting ingredients, right? Fries. They're supposed to be buns or baps or whatever you want to call them. I don't even know what they are. They're supposed to be beef patties. This is a pickle if you're in America or a gherkin if you're in England. You might be a perking in Australia, I don't know. And drinks, okay? You take these ingredients here. Then you take idiot. These people don't know anything, right? You take these idiots and what do they produce? Pretty decent food. Reasonably decent food. Lies. That's a lie.
I only hope you won't compare Ubuntu to McDonald's.
No, we're not going to compare Ubuntu to McDonald's. But what we're doing here is, even whether you think the food's crap, whether you don't like the food or not, what they've done is they've taken the ability to take mundane ingredients, people who are generally not motivated, not interested, pretty stupid, apart from the guy with the key who goes and fixes all the problems in the till. He's like Superman at McDonald's. You take these people, and they can spit out a product that's liked by millions of people. And that's the thing. What they've done here is they've defined some process. Now, if they can do it, right, they're dealing with idiots. We've got good people. You know, those people over there, they're doing well. But these people are good people. They just have got that piece missing from the jigsaw. Right? So if they can do it, we can do it. So the rule here is we need to think about our community, what it involves, and figure out ways to define a process that works. And this varies between different communities. We can't have the same process for vastly different types of work. For example, programmers. Programmers live in bug trackers, you know? Bug trackers are what drives much of the programming world. Artists, doesn't work. The concept of a bug tracker, even if it's a bug, even if it's something wrong with a piece of software, a bug tracker, it doesn't fit that kind of way of doing things. Like, different people work in different ways. A lot of programmers can work independently. A lot of artists like to work together and collaborate. There's different ways in which people work, and we need to identify those ways and those personalities and create a process that works for those different types of people. And that's absolutely, absolutely critical. Absolutely critical. So let's spin this back to the open source community, right? Represented by Debian and the dude with green hair. When you're thinking about this process, part of it is that you need to also remember that developing a community is organic. It's not something we can set in stone. The minute you start saying, okay, if you're going to be part of our documentation team, you must do this, 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 and this, and no matter what happens, those rules will always be the same. What you're creating there is bureaucracy. You're not creating process. Okay? The process has got to adjust and manipulate with the way the community works, and different people will come into the community and have different effects on that community. And part of that is also understanding that communities grow and change in different ways. There's different types of developers and users who are pushing it. So, for example, 10 years ago, when I first got into Linux, this guy, pretty representative of the kind of developer that you have. You know, hardcore C developer creates a kernel, like him, Alan Cox, and ducks. That's the only reason I put this photo in. I love ducks. In a professional way. Professional Dutchland. And then, of course, on the desktop sort of side, you'd have people like Miguel de Caza, who was unfortunately born with hands too big. Now, these days things have changed. We've still got people like this involved. You know, we've got very hardcore developers involved, people who are interested in a very strong technical grounding. But we've got different types of people, like these guys. This is, on the left, we've got a guy called Mark van der Boer. He runs the Belgian Ubuntu team. On the right here, we've got a guy called Og Michael, who is the bastard child of Og Vorbis and George Michael. he runs the Brazilian team. So these guys are more involved in kind of outreach, advocacy, that kind of stuff. We've also got people like these two guys. On the left, we've got a guy called Andre who does anthropology, and this guy, Rolf, does forum stuff. I like this slide for two reasons. Okay, first of all, you know, it explains the point I'm trying to make. And secondly, you get the impression that just before this picture was taken, Rolf was kind of like, Andre was probably sat here, kind of like leaned up against the pillar having a drink. And then you get the impression that Rolf was over here with a bottle in the brown paper bag kind of going... I just love that photo. He really doesn't want to be stood next to him. And then, of course, you've got commentators in the world, like LeGradio is one example. Anyone listen to LeGradio? Yeah, more like it. LeGradio. So, you know, you've got these different kind of groups and types of people now, augmenting the kind of people that we had years ago. And what this is diversity. And again, when building communities, we need to understand that diversity is something that's absolutely intrinsic in those different communities. We can't expect people who obey a certain culture of work in a certain kind of perspective to work to the rules and grounding of somebody who's completely different. And people do work in different ways. And the open source community has become so hugely diverse that we need to always remember, we always need to remember these aspects when building strong communities. Now, I work at Canonical, I work on Ubuntu, so I need to talk about Ubuntu. Well, I'm not forced to talk about Ubuntu, but it's interesting. All right, this is the usual thing. Everyone put their hands up. Everyone, come on. Up. Okay, put your hands down if you use Ubuntu. Okay, put your hands down if you use Fedora. OpenSUSE? No hands go down. Gentoo. Debian. Ooh, lots of Debian people. This is a great way of finding the weirdos in the audience. My good friend here. What do you use? Slackware. Okay. Less said about that, the better. Please? Slackware. Okay. Slackware? Mac OS X. Okay. Anyone else use anything weird? Oh, we've got a dude there. What do you use? Manziva. Excellent. 1999 called, they want their operating system back. Anyone else? Any of it? What? Arch. Arch is cool. Cool. No. Shaking her head. That's crap. So Ubuntu. Ubuntu, they drink it in the jungle. Ubuntu is a project that's huge. We have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people involved in the project. And these are the kind of teams that we've got. And they span all across the world. There's all kinds of different things going on. It's a fantastic community to be a part of. When I worked my previous job, my job was going to come to an end in March this year because it was a funded project. And I only wanted to work for one company, that was Canonical, because I just thought the direction of Ubuntu and the grounding behind Ubuntu is the right way to do things. What? Fridge is a news site. It's like a community-driven news site. The Fridge, fridge.ubuntu.com. So we got lots of these different teams, each heading in their own direction, and part of this is, of course, making these teams work together and making sure new people can join teams, all of the points I made earlier on, okay? And there's lots and lots going on. One thing I wanted to do was to kind of give you an idea of the size and the scope of the Ubuntu community, but I really understand that stats are lies. however, these stats aren't lies. So this gives you an idea of the kind of scope of the Ubuntu community. We've got over 8 million users. That's a lot of users. We've got these loco teams, these geographical located teams. We've got there's now over 100. We have loco teams in pretty much every country in the world now, and I'm going to throw up a map in a bit to show you them. 13,000 loco team subscribers on the mailing list. When I checked that the first time, it was in November, it was 11,000. So the project's grown hugely with the loco team. 211,000 forums members, over 2 million forums posts, 18,000 wiki pages. You know, there's loads of stats. You know, I don't even want to get into the data transfer stats because it's ridiculous how much information is pumped out when Ubuntu releases. It's a huge project. There's lots and lots going on. But the thing is that with Ubuntu, Ubuntu's gone from no users to, you know, 8 million users in just over 2 years. which is a pretty impressive leap in my mind. And I was asking the question, well, why on earth is this happening? Why is it being so successful? Why aren't other distros, why haven't they grown in such a short amount of time? There's lots of users of other distros, but it seems like the Ubuntu growth has been remarkable. And I always thought of this before I joined Canonical as well. I'm not just feeding you the party line. And to me, the reason why I picked Ubuntu when I first heard about it and the reason why I became interested in working at Canonical is because community is a number one thing. You know, a lot of you will be familiar with the fact that community for a lot of distros is, well, certainly back a couple of years ago, was we'd have this distro and the community is this kind of thing that we push to the side. You know, it's something that we tolerate. We don't encourage, we just tolerate this community. And a lot of businesses have made mistakes by doing that. And we mentioned Mandriva. To me, Mandriva should have had the success that Ubuntu had. Because back in 1998, 1999, it was the easy-to-use Linux distribution. But the community's got to be a central point in that. And we've seen a change where larger companies now are really trying to place community as a center point. And building community after the fact is very difficult. It's easier to build community right at the beginning and then build brand. Whereas a lot of these companies already had brand and then started building community. So community has to be absolutely centrally focused. The other thing is governance. Governance, this is how the community works. It needs to be open. We talk about, in the Ubuntu project, we talk a lot about the water cooler situation. For some distributions, for some projects, they might have an open process, but you might get developers working together in an office somewhere, and they'll stand at the water cooler and they'll talk about different bits and pieces, and they'll never get communicated out to the outside world. Not because they're malicious, just because that's the way businesses work. People come up with ideas, they don't go and blab it to everybody every time they have an idea about something. Certainly, all of the core developers in the Ubuntu project who are employed by Canonical work from home. And everyone works out in the open. So all discussion is in mailing lists, it's in public ISD channels. So you automatically get away from that water cooler issue. So the project automatically becomes more open. The interesting thing with governance is making sure that governance isn't just something that Canonical people are allowed to be involved in. Because this is the Ubuntu project. Canonical is a sponsor of the project. You know? It's everybody's project. And part of, so we've got a community council, and anybody can be on the community council. If you're good, and you're respected in the Ubuntu community for doing good work, then it's likely that you might get on the community council. You know, it's an open process. We've written legislation and rules and process that say, this is open to everybody. This is a project, this is an open project as far as we can make it. So governance is absolutely, absolutely critical. But the other thing is making sure that there's a worldwide presence. This is the loco map that I was talking about. Where you see blue and green on this map, this is where we've got Ubuntu loco teams. And as you can see, pretty much the entire world is covered. And this is growing all the time. The difference between the blue and green is we have approved teams and non-approved teams. So approved teams are teams that we've identified and the community council has identified are doing good, repeatable work. So what we do is we're more willing to send them, you know, laptops and projector equipment and things like that for conferences. You know, we can rely on these people a lot more than a team that's just appeared and hasn't done anything yet. And any team can apply to be an approved member. And if they've done good work, then they become an approved member of the community council. So the green ones are the approved teams and the blue ones are non-approved. When I joined Canonical, there was a big backlog of teams that were waiting for approval, and that's what I'm trying to work through. So hopefully this time next year, this is going to be pretty much mostly green.
So you have to make sure the UK approved.
It is now. This is old. Is Melissa in here? No? Blame her. Yeah? Black, that's Lake. Yeah, it's the Ubuntu-fish. So, thing is, you get this worldwide presence, and I'm really interested in the local project because the local project defines interesting local people because we often on the internet we often look at things at this just generic global village kind of level, but there's a lot of value in localized teams and the amount of teams who've got in touch with me and said, you know, for example, we had a team in Turkey. Converted all of Ubuntu into Kurdish. There's a large proportion of people who live in Turkey speak Kurdish, and it's a restricted language in Turkey. And they had a press conference, and they had like major press coming out and covering this. It's a big deal over there. And you get little things like that going on that most of us are probably not going to hear of, but in that part of the world it makes a big deal. And the other thing is that, you know, if you speak English and you live in a Western country, then you've got an easy life. But if you don't speak English, if you don't live in a Western country, then it's a whole different ball game. And this is part of the reason why we invest so much time in making sure that Ubuntu is available in different languages, there's different locales. And it really is a global project, because everything's nice in your own language. And we always need to remember that. And I knew at this point that I'd be running out of time, which I am. And we're probably going to want to have a couple of questions. Aim of this slide is, I could stand here for the entire LCA and babble on about community, and I still wouldn't get through all the stuff I'd want to talk to you about. I can only provide a certain amount of stuff in this presentation. I hope some of it's been useful. If you're interested in any of this, you want to continue the conversation, come and grab me. I'm going to be leaving. I'm flying back to England on Saturday. But by all means, you know, come and give me a shout. So that's me done. Any questions? Dude, him. Oh, we need to... Old green hair needs to run up the steps. Okay.
You were talking about getting with the first four steps you had, like the third one was new users.
Yeah.
You just said a lot of things that wouldn't get you new users.
Right. Like what?
Well, you talked about things like you know, old log members, not you know.
Oh right, yeah.
You defined a lot of things that were bad into or unsuccessful ways of getting new users. Can you give us some successful ways of getting new users?
I've been thinking about this quite a lot with regards to people joining new projects. An example of this is if somebody wants to join, let's say, they want to do some packaging, okay? If they've done some maybe done some Debian packaging before and they want to join the Ubuntu project and do some packaging. They join a team, this could be any team, they join a team and instantly they're thrown in at the deep end. There's no indication of what tasks are easier than other tasks. You're just thrown in and you're expected to fight your way until you manage to do something successfully. And in my mind, we always need, for new people, whether you're advocating things or whether you're people are joining teams, we always need to associate success and something you've done pretty quickly. So, for example, a good way to advocate Linux is to get people using Firefox. It works the same as IE. They get a positive experience out of it. It's really easy. You know, moving them to Linux is a lot more difficult. And so I've been thinking about, for example, creating bite-sized tasks for things that each project would have bite-sized tasks, little things that are easy to do. The kind of things that the core developers probably don't have time for, but are a nice, easy thing for people to get involved in. And that's something that I'm working on at the moment in the Ubuntu project. So people can join a team, they can get a list of simple things that they can contribute, and then that helps ease them into the water. Little things like that help the process. Lots of documentation. We're also trialing mentoring schemes. We've done mentoring schemes between different loco teams, and little things like that.
Just wondering, you said about the canonical and sponsorship of the project. How do you... You know, do you have much problems with people going, oh, that person's getting paid for this, I'm not getting paid for it, I don't want to help out, or getting annoyed about their bit not getting sponsored, or how the decision's made on who should get sponsorship versus who shouldn't, things like that?
Well, the way the sponsorship basically works is that we fund a core set of developers, and then those developers are funded, and beyond those developers, people join the project, and in many cases, you know, people who join the project and do good work get hired. But the sponsorship is basically funding a chunk of development and engineering time into the project. There are certain situations where individual projects have been funded in different ways. Generally, certainly, I mean, I've been at Canonical, I only started in September, and I've never seen any bitching about my project wasn't picked and that project was picked. But it's a fairly flat sponsorship thing. You know, we hire the core development team, we hire a bunch of launchpad people, we hire you know, people like myself to do the community side. We've got a business development team, you know, things like that. And they're employed by Canonical to contribute to Ubuntu. And then that's pretty much the way it works. Yeah. But this guy's a legend, by the way.
And I thought that was only in my own mind.
You've got to be nice to me now.
I'm usually nice to
you. Yeah, you are.
So, in one of your slides earlier, you mentioned how companies should work on developing community. There are two classic flaws that companies in this space make time and time again, and that is, even if they think about community, they don't think about what opportunity do their programs, and I don't mean software programs, I mean their policies, their activities, and so on, create for people in the community. If your community simply exists to support you as a company or to help spread the product, it's not that compelling. Good community programs ensure that you share opportunity with everyone who should have a stake in the project.
Yeah.
the other thing. And so you may have a company that does that part right, but they get hungry for good people, and they end up accidentally hiring away every community leader, and they starve out the community.
Yeah.
All the people who should be helping new users become productive, to feel worthwhile in the project and so on, get hired into the company. They start working on really important projects and have no time to do the stuff that they were doing that made them such a great hire in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think this is often a problem when companies do invest in communities, is that it's got to scale. It's got to be kind of relative to the growth of that community in itself. And it, you know, there's been criticism leveled towards Ubuntu with the same thing with hiring Debian developers. And I think some of that criticism is fair. You know, I mean, and it is difficult. I think the thing is that the big problem that I think a lot of companies have is that they fundamentally do not understand the way community works. I think most people don't understand the way community works. I'm not going to profess that I understand how it works. We've all got our own different views on things. But a lot of companies try and treat it with the business model and the business way of doing things. And they don't realize that people work in different ways. If I was hiring a community developer, I'd want them to be doing largely the same work that they've been doing in that community. I wouldn't want to take them and then reassign them somewhere else because they're going to get pissed off and they're not going to be happy. So.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Hello.
I don't think you actually touched the topic about the biggest problem I've had with community so far. People who talk and don't code.
People who what? Talk and don't code?
Yeah.
Right.
As in, not in a good sense, but just armchair activism without actually contributing anything concrete.
Yeah.
So how do
you... Vaporware kind of armchair pundits. Yeah, I agree. And this is something that plagues everything. You know, there's always going to be people who have views about the world and never do anything about it. And there's lots of people, I mean, in one of the previous talks, there was talk about how planets are a really great way to promote your business, to promote your software project. And one of the downsides of planets is that there's an awful lot of commentators who bang on about nothing and ultimately contribute nothing. And a lot of people like talking. A lot of people like talking, and even though they've got the ability to fix something, they're unwilling to fix something. And I think this is something that's difficult, and it's always going to plague the open source community, because it doesn't just plague us, it plagues everything. In the same way that my brother might have a negative opinion about something that's going on in his area, but he's unwilling to get out of his house and actually contribute to fix that. You know, because some people just want to complain and not actually do something. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Hello.
Earlier on, you said you work from home, and I assume you use software tools to help you communicate with the community. Are all these software tools open source?
Yes, in Ubuntu. At Canonical, we use IRC, mailing lists, voice over IP, everything I use on my computer is free software, and everything. I'm not going to deny, we do have an internal company wiki for client projects and things like that to do with the business side, but everything with software development with Ubuntu is completely out in the open on the wiki. Yeah. Launchpad's not open source.
So getting back to the bozos, you talked about the people who talk and don't do. So that falls into the category of the idiots that you said weren't the people that need help to become productive members of the community and self-sustaining.
Yep.
And you said, but everybody can tell who they are. They posted a Slashdot. That was really glib. It's really hard to tell who the good guys and who the bad guys are from a distance. And often it takes a lot of effort to realize, you know, this guy's never going to get clue. This guy's never going to code. Yep. They're a waste of time.
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways you can identify people who are quite clearly uninterested or unable to participate. And then the difficult ones, I think, are the kind of like the, there's like a jigsaw piece missing from this group of people here. And for some people, there's a much bigger jigsaw piece than other people. And the difficulty is thinking that they are the people who are idiots. I mean, I remember, for example, I'm in a local Linux user group. And this guy joined our group. He broke all of the mailing list etiquette. He made all of the mistakes that you associate with a troll, with somebody who makes all of those kinds of things happen. But he just didn't know what to do. And when he acknowledged that he was stuck He didn't really know how to move forward, and people helped him. He became a really core member of that group. And it was easy, and we all did kind of discount this guy as just being a waste of space. And sometimes we've got to kind of step back, and I think that's something that happens with maturity, because I think like certain members of the group who were less familiar with open source in the community were much quicker to kind of push this guy away than other people who'd seen similar instances when that happened. I mean, I think my statement earlier on was probably too glib in the fact that it's not really, really easy to identify people who are idiots. But I think it's clear people who are good people, and we want to kind of focus on those where we can.
Two more short questions. We're on overtime already.
We're on overtime. Break the rule.
All right, this was briefly alluded to earlier, and you probably won't like it, but I'm going to say it nonetheless.
Shoot.
Okay, I'm an admin on a translation team, and we've decided to use Rosetta as our translation tool, and it's absolutely fantastic, and we've managed to extend it with some Firefox scripts and so on. Grease monkey script. That's great, but we've got to the stage where we've done a 100% translation, but there are other things we'd love to do, but we can only do so with perhaps getting access to the code.
Right.
We've tried to contact the developers.
Which code, by the way?
The Launchpad code, or the Rosetta code, more specifically.
What do you need to do to that requires the code?
Well, we were... Our plan was to, and this is something that affects just about any language with multiple dialects. In my situation, it's British English, which is more or less quite easy to do. But the problem is you have an Australian team, you have a Canadian team, you have an Indian team, and so on, all doing almost identically the same thing. They're producing their own independent translation.
Okay.
Now you have the same situation with Spanish, with Chinese, with all these other languages. The way it's set up at the moment is that we have to independently do them.
Oh, so you're saying now, there's stuff in Rosetta that needs to be in Rosetta.
Well, what we'd like to have, and we've mentioned this to developers, but they're just sitting on it, and they don't appear to be very responsive. So this is about, basically this question is about developer responsiveness and so on.
Right.
Basically what we'd like to have is derivative languages. So you could, for instance, have a master language and then have branches off that.
Yeah.
Instead of having to do each one from scratch. But we're not getting the best response.
Right.
I mean, they appear to be interested. They say, yes, we're interested, and that's it.
I mean, the thing is, I think there's two responses to this question. One response is, Launchpad isn't on my watch. So I don't deal with the Launchpad team really all that much. There's a guy called Matt Ravel who's kind of a point man for Launchpad. And I think if you're having problems with this needs to be fixed. I mean, if you're kind of, even if they say no, you know, not, unresponsive developers in any company is bad, and that's not a good thing. Launchpad is closed source, Rosetta is closed source, and that means that we can't just hack in features and stuff like that, and for various reasons. And I'm not the best person to talk about this because I'm Ubuntu and not Launchpad. But yeah, I agree with you. And I think it should be better. The best thing to do is I'll talk to Matt Ravel and kind of mention these things, and hopefully he can get back in touch with you.
He's on my team.
He's on your team. Which team are you on?
British English translation.
NGV. Does he actually do any translation?
No.
We're done, are we?
So, Jono, Ubuntu has taken the Linux user world by storm over the last few years. Suppose your evil twin came back and got hired by one of the other distros to take back market share. What sort of advice would you give them except for blindly copying Ubuntu?
For making a good distro? I'd say that what's going to make or break a distro is how much they appreciate and understand the free software ethic that's rampant throughout all communities. In varying degrees, we've all got different definitions of what freedom means. And different definitions of how we work together. The distros that are doing well, I think, are the distros that have an understanding of that. You know, look at Gentoo, look at Debian, look at Ubuntu. The distros that are doing less well are the distros that don't have an understanding of that. You know, a good example of that is Zandros. They don't really participate anywhere near as much as any of the other distros, and they're having less success. So I'd say understand that community is absolutely critical to that. Work with that community. Don't try to control it. And it's going to have a positive impact. And then, of course, you've got to make a good product, you know, which is a whole other thing. But I'd say, that certainly from my perspective, you've got to place that community at number one. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Sorry?
One of the beer glasses.
Oh, wow.